This is Sung Soo, with some good news and some sombering news. For the good news, Muzon Minis continues to be incredible in their support of myself and my War Machine-related forays. They've created a discount code, MileHighMuse, which will net my listeners 10% off, which is incredible. You can find slash follow them at Muzon Minis, and their websites are MuzonMinis.com, where you can find this and all of my other podcasts, and Muzon Store, where you can find all their wonderful products. It's worth noting that this discount code works across all brands, anything from officially branded Guild Ball tokens to Infinity Objectives to the War Machine tokens we all love. The discount code MileHighMuse entered at checkout will grant you 10% off. A huge thanks to Muse for allowing me to pass this along to all of my listeners. Be sure to give them a like and a follow on social media, and consider them when looking for high-quality gaming accessories. In addition, Muse is kicking back a percentage of every purchase using this code to support me. This was certainly not expected and beyond my expectations I had when Muse reached out to me, but it got me thinking. For a statistical convergence, it's Stussy and I. For tactical tips, it's Pat, Tim, and myself. On tangential even, I've had 13 episodes with 16 different guests. So instead of keeping the money, I've decided to donate it to a charity, which will periodically rotate. For the remainder of 2018, any support funds donated from using Mile High Muse on checkout will be donated to Han Wheeler in support of his courageous battle with cancer. Han is one of our own, a wargamer and a young man fighting for his life. His father, Josh, is host of Chain Attack, and my heart goes out to them and their family during this time. I'm all in on Team Han. Never tell me the odds. Be thankful for what you have, gamers. Remember that it's just a game. Welcome to episode... Fuck. Screwed it up already. This is going to be great. Thanks, Pat.
No problem, I got you.
Welcome to episode... God damn it. Welcome to episode 3 of Tactical Tips 2.0. I'm Sung Soo, and I'm excited to be here today. Today, we'll be taking a look at P-Scar in Dark Host. But before we begin, let's check in with the experts, Tim and Pat. Tim, how are you holding up?
I'm doing spectacular. I like that you say P-Scar because that's not a concept in the game anymore. I think it's just Scar 1. But you're showing people there that you've got some P for pedigree.
I guess you're right. I guess I don't call Scar 2 Epic Scar anymore, but I could make a comeback.
You could call Scar 3 Legendary Scar. That was a thing that some people did for a while that was stupid.
See, I wasn't actually playing the game when that came out, I don't think. So. Yeah, I guess I am dating myself a little bit here. I'm older than people may think. Pat, how's everything going on your side of the world?
Just great, thank you. No complaints. Let's move it along.
Yeah, so let's just jump right on into it. So for today's episode, I thought we could take a list that's been all over the place. This list is David Beauchamp from Team Canada Beaver from the WTC. There are some variations on the list, but the one we're going to talk about today specifically is his. He's running Pirate Queen Scar, also known as P-Scar, with four Stalkers, a Scarlock, Banelord Tartarus, Daregith Wraith, three Scrap Thralls, which is a single choice, a Min unit of Bane Riders, a Min unit of Bane Warriors, including the Officer and Standard, Cephalix Overlords, and two Wraith Engines. So I open it up to the experts. What is this list trying to do?
Before I get stuck into what this is trying to do, I just have to ask, did you call him Daregith?
Oh God, are we gonna
Daregith Wraith?
I've heard Daryl, I've heard Darag, I've heard like Dara Wraith, like that, like yeah. a kind of a soft end, but I've never quite heard the what I'm gonna now call the Sung Soo special. And if you edit this out,
I just have to own it at this stage. I'm pretty sure I did call him Daregith Wraith.
Yeah.
And I mean, full disclosure, like I've played Krix probably the most out of any faction. I think I've always called him that. I think if you say anything and gesture towards the model, most of the time your opponent just agrees with you. So how do you pronounce Daregith Wraith?
Yeah. I think the technically correct pronunciation is Dara, because it is an Irish word, right? It's Gaelic.
I have no idea. So. I'm while technically I am somewhat Irish, that is in name only.
Well, Kieran Bolger insists that the name is Dara, and I believe him. He's loud and Irish enough for me to 100% believe the name is Dara, so I just go with that.
When Karen insists on something, it's really just not worth fighting him. He's very passionate and a lovely human being, and I'll say nothing negative about him.
I mean, okay, while we're on the subject, is it Wraith or Wrath then?
I don't even know the answer to that.
Yeah, no, you know what? Let's say anything is right unless you say what Sung said earlier.
So I am to believe that you have had long conversations with an Irishman about the enunciation of the model, but you have never referred to the model's last name. You've only talked about the first name. That's what I am to believe here?
Yes.
Okay, great. So what's the list trying to do?
We're on a first-name basis with this man.
So what is this trying to do? It's a melee list. It's got a couple of really nice strengths. So it's taking advantage of Scar's strengths being, well, in particular, her ability to multiply the effectiveness of melee models with dark guidance for an extra dice on attack rolls for everything in her control area, and her feat to give specific models +5 strength per turn. Now, the synergy in this list, from a big picture point of view, is you're taking a bunch of Banes who are themselves hard-hitting, but not especially accurate. You're increasing the accuracy with Scar, and you're taking the hitting power from high to off the charts. You're also taking advantage of the fact that in this theme force, Banes are fairly resistant to missile attacks. You've got various layers of defense. You've got Prowl from the theme force on all of your Banes. You've got the clouds from the theme force. You've got the protective aura from Wraith engines. As well as the resiliency of some of the models with high armor, hit points, vengeance. What you miss in Scar lists is you don't have good threat projection. So the list is also trying to take advantage of models with good innate melee threat ranges. So that's Stalkers who have Leap, Wraith Engines at speed 7 with Reach, and Bane Riders who are Cavalry plus Vengeance. So that you can apply your really accurate, really hard-hitting models where you need to.
I mean, you mentioned threat ranges. Also, obviously, Dara is a threat extension piece. Also, if you're playing a melee list and you end up closing the gap fairly effectively, which this list does, Dara very quickly switches to Mortal Fear, which is a very, very powerful effect. Debuffs nearly all of the things that you encounter. He affects living models, but he affects not just their melee attacks, but also their ranged attacks. He just decreases damage done by melee models in a very, very large bubble. And is personally a really resilient piece that can often be screened by things. It's worth mentioning this list is a light incorporeal skew, a pretty heavy stealth skew, so it presents challenges to a lot of lists that just don't have tools necessary to deal with these things. Wraith engines are better than most incorporeal pieces. A lot of lists will pay deference to incorporeal as a problem because they want to be able to kill Gremlin Swarms for the Grimkin matchup, or they want to kill Black Banes are a thing that people would attend to in a very relevant way. Wraith engines are multi-box incorporeal models. Not only are they, armor 20 against shooting, sometimes armor 20 against melee attacks, depending on the positioning of Dara and what's attacking them, but they're also battle engines with multiple boxes. So they're in a very, very strong situation against a lot of lists that don't have really good solves to those things.
Just wanted to throw out another strength of this list. It's very good at dealing with terrain because almost every model is either incorporeal or ghostly. The ones that aren't, I think, all have Pathfinder. So it's very good at playing on lots of different tables and really abusing terrain.
Scar herself is really resilient, and she doesn't have to do a lot other than cast Dark Guidance. Ritual Sacrifice is obviously a really, really powerful spell. She can Ritual Sacrifice Scrap Thralls. Depending on the matchup, sometimes she'll Ritual Sacrifice Bane Warriors if you just urgently need extra solos to score in different places. This list is tight on models for Ritual Sacrifice, but that's kind of okay because you really only need to play 4 turns of the game most of the time. The Scarlet Thrall can also Ritual Sacrifice himself, which is something a lot of people aren't necessarily aware of. And that's, obviously that's the last time he's going to do it. But when he does, you still generate that extra D6 focus.
How does he Ritual Sacrifice himself? That's interesting.
Yeah, it targets a warrior model. He is one. And you can target yourself with the spell.
Because it's not an offensive spell. Got it.
Yeah.
Even though it kills a model, obviously it's not offensive because you're only targeting on friendly things. That makes sense.
Indeed. Cute, right? That's actually Scar can ritual sacrifice herself.
If you want a classy way to concede a game.
That's not necessarily a strategy I would recommend, but it is an option that's available to you. Honorable mention here in the list to the Cephalix Overlords, who are not just tech for Grimkin, having access to magical sprays, but they can do an enormous amount of infantry clearing work, and they also can line up sprays in Dark Shroud auras from either the Wraith Engines or the Bane Warriors, and thereby make those sprays effectively POW 14. And because they ignore line of sight with those sprays, they can line them up from behind terrain in favorable positions, or they can target models that are sort of way out of relevancy to get exactly the vector they want, usually not spraying any of your own models, and get a ton of infantry or value targets underneath those sprays when they do. They do a huge amount of work in this list. Like, assuming you do a good job of protecting them, and there's no reason for you not to, they can be spectacularly relevant models.
Sorry. I was going to say, I think it's just worth emphasizing that this unit is really good, I think, in the current meta. And almost, I'm not going to say every, but it might be every Krix theme, or certainly most of them, have access to it because it's a mercenary unit. So I think it's worth considering with a lot of different casters and a lot of different lists, just as a solve for dealing with incorporeal models, for dealing with massed infantry, being able to handle flanks pretty well. It's great in a lot of situations.
They're also a small scoring unit, which is quite relevant. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, you want to put up a ton of pressure, you've captured a lot of table space, your opponent sort of backed out of the threat range of Stalkers, and you now are ready to feat, and you want to put your Riders in on hard targets, you want to put your Warriors in on hard targets, you want to charge, you know, everything, and Scar needs to be right at the middle of the board, you know, either behind clouds or protected by other pieces. She's picked a spot where she can bunker down and stay really, really safe, because she's kind of a vulnerability point for the list sometimes. In that sense, she can't necessarily commit to scoring a circular zone. On that key turn where all of your pieces need to do work, the Cephalix Overlords are often in a position to be able to relevantly score the zone and still even capitalize on making use of their sprays.
Tim brings up a great point, and a couple times you've talked about scenario and you talked about turn limits. So does this list MO change dramatically in different scenarios?
No, it does not. This list is... what should I say here? I think what it's going to do is it's going to hit you really, really hard. It's going to hit you really, really fast. It's going to hit you really accurately. It's going to leverage a ton of damage. It's going to make use of its resiliency. And then at some point in the game, you're going to fold under the weight of its attrition pressure, and it's going to start to capitalize on scenario points. You're going to keep models away from it, so it's going to capitalize on scenario points, or you're going to force yourself to do more work with your caster than you have business doing, and it's going to kill you with Stalkers. I think that the changes I might make to the way I play this list would be in what models get ritual sacrificed if there was a specific opening in Mirage. Otherwise, I don't know if my line of play changes. Is that different for you, Pat?
No, I agree, and I think one of the reasons for that is the way this list naturally plays. If there was no scenario on the table, it would be playing across the whole table because all of the models ignore everything on the board for movement. And it would be playing in depth because the models have different speeds and they want to be covering as much of the table as possible to take advantage of their threat. And just by doing that game plan, you're naturally playing to scenario. And I don't think this list really needs to be trying very hard to play on scenario. And a lot of the times when I see Dark Hoster in a good matchup, they're almost accidentally winning on scenario because they're just positioning to minimize the amount of damage they're taking from range and to maximize their table coverage and their threat vectors. And by doing that, they just happen to be scoring or contesting every point, and anything that comes into their threat range gets murdered.
I think in a lot of ways, it's worth pointing out that Scar herself is a bit of a shark. She hasn't really evolved in like a millennium, and you know, she's this thousand-year-old creature who, like, every once in a while, like, a fin shifts a little bit, but otherwise is more or less the same animal she's been since Mark One. The things that you play with her, the ingredients in the list, like themes, have sort of tailored her a bit specifically and tweaked the tech that she plays. But she's always looking to have a couple of cute pieces and a very, very linear, very, very powerful game plan themed around the combination of accuracy and damage potential.
Okay. And then for any new Krix player, what are some tips for piloting this list? How high is the skill floor needed to really get into this list?
So I think this is a fairly simple list to get to grips with. I think the floor for this list is quite low, and that's because Scar's core game plan is very simple and easy to execute, right? You apply buffs to your own models, you charge with those models, you kill whatever you've charged. That's the plan in a nutshell. So because that core plan is easy to execute, I think it's quite a forgiving list for a new player. And the emphasis really is on the opponent, because like Tim said, the plan is very linear. Both people know what Scar is going to do when you sit down to play. And it's really up to the opponent to figure out, huh, how am I going to stop this from happening? And then the skill for the Scar player is anticipating that and knowing those countermoves and making the opponent's plans as difficult as possible while still being able to threaten with your melee presence.
Yeah, she's pretty simple to pick up. Real key tip, protect Scar. You're going to be in a situation where a lot of the time, if you get your feet as an alpha and not feeding defensively, which we'll talk about in a few moments here, if you alpha very effectively with Scar's list, you take a whole ton of damage, and then you begin to aggressively win the game. You put yourself in a position where you are officially winning. And you've started the point where your opponent is so far behind, they may look at the table and say, well, I guess I just have to assassinate you now. Anticipate that at the end of your feat turn, you should be, if not literally unassailable, at least nigh unassailable. Always feed on Scar. There is probably a threshold of skill where you realize that sometimes you don't have to feed on Scar. If you're a newer Krix player playing this list, just pretend that doesn't exist yet. Imagine you're going to be there in a year and just play 300 games with her before you ever stop feeding on Scar. She should always be one of her own feed targets. If you're not playing against trolls, she should take the objective that heals her, and terrain permitting, you should be behind a cloud or behind a line of sight blocking piece, near enough to the objective that you can get yourself healed back up fairly quickly. If you're rolling sixes for ritual sacrifice, you should be making use of the superfluous focus available to yourself to heal, but you should always be in a position where you're camping a couple of points. It's often the right call to heal for a couple of points if you've got a generous stack of focus on your own feet turn. She's a very, very powerful melee presence and is quite good at doing work herself. Just don't do that. I don't know what to say here other than, like, these are tips for new Krix players. Seasoned Krix players may have different opinions, and that's perfectly acceptable. But just play the surface of the list for a while, because it's a very, very good surface, and then start to explore that depth only later on. She's got some great tools in her kit, including Ritual Sacrifice, or pardon me, not Ritual Sacrifice, Sacrificial Strike. Sacrificial Strike is absolutely key in the Grimkin matchup if you don't have Overlords in your list. It's one of the only ways you have to kill Gremlin Swarms. It's also a really hard ability to use without getting your caster killed, so just be really careful with it. I think tips for new players in this list are play the very, very surface of the list and start to dig a little bit deeper only after you're very secure in how that plays. This is a math and a positioning oriented list. You're really going to spend a bunch of time just like figuring out numbers and stuff. Do that. And don't be afraid to be like, if I pointed that thing with models, it should probably die. That's mostly accurate in this list, but sometimes you have to like realize how many models you have to point at something for it to die.
Yeah, one of the common mistakes that I see made with this list is just the misallocation of resources on melee attacks, and especially placement issues. This really comes into play because you have the leaps from the Stalkers and you have the double huge bases from the Wraith Engines. It can get tricky sometimes to concentrate your damage and your attacks exactly where you want them. And one way to fall behind with Scar is you pop feet, you cast Dark Guidance, you charge in, but you can't get the attacks you need on key models because you've blocked yourself with your Wraith Engines and your large base cavalry.
Mm-hmm. It's also worth pointing out that you should make relevant attacks with your feet on Wraith Engines, and then maybe you should stop making attacks with your Wraith Engines. There's a lot of matchups that you can win really, really oppressively just because Wraith Engines are unkillable without magic weapons. And a lot of the time, you can kill the things on the feat turn that have magical weapons with, say, Stalkers or Banecav or Overlords or, you know, the things that are in your list. And if you do so, and they are left without the tools necessary to meaningfully interact with the Wraith Engines, they never get to score anything in the scenario ever. And you win the game.
Yeah, it's definitely, they're really interesting pieces, right? Because they're one of the more extreme pieces in the game that can just be immune to some armies. So when you sit down across your opponent, you need to be looking at their army and thinking, how can they possibly kill my Wraith Engines? Sometimes the answer is obvious, and you realize, okay, the Wraith Engine is just going to be a useful value piece in this game, like some sort of heavy. But sometimes you realize only their caster can do it, and that can completely change how you approach the game. Because suddenly it makes it impossible for you to lose on scenario, and that can just dictate every move your opponent makes.
Keep in mind before you roll off for turn that you select your objective before determining side choice. So if you're the Scar player, it's intelligent for you to say, like, okay, we've defined the terrain on the table and we've picked what lists we're playing. Which objective are you playing? And they'll say, like, I guess I have to take magical weapons. And then you can put them on a side where a Pathfinder objective would have been necessary for them to do work that was key to them if you end up with the side choice. Or they have to choose a side where they're open enough that they can be safe, so forcing them to take second turn, which then in turn gives you first turn, and you don't care where you are because your list is almost entirely terrain agnostic.
No, that's a great point, Tim, and I know that came up recently when you and I were playing at the Boker Brawl, and someone was caught off guard by that, but it's a fantastic pregame timing thing that I think a lot of people don't know or don't consider. I'm just going to double down on this, and so I think Derageth Wraith is worth his own talking point here. He's a super solo with a slew of rules that makes him very impactful and keeps himself alive, pun intended there. So what are some things we should know about him before we start playing Peacecar?
Just as a precursor question to this question, is there a word in the English language where a GH is pronounced GH?
I mean, that's never stopped me before, Tim. I'm sure I could find one, and I probably will. I can right now ask everyone on social media to help me out there if we could possibly justify my enunciation of that solo's name.
Like, could I make a tug check? Like...
Here's what I will say is, like, as I've met people over the years and as I've heard people try to pronounce my name, like, names don't follow normal enunciation rules. Like, you could name your kid anything, say it's pronounced any which way you want, and then for the rest of that poor kid's life, they have to follow this. And if something was to drive me to want to become a lich, it could be something like my parents giving me a horrible name.
Well, okay, so credit where it's due, first of all. Dara is not a lich. He's actually a living dude. And that's important to note because a lot of people think this list is entirely undead and it has a living model in it. So your poison attacks are relevant and paralysis can be key.
Isn't he aspiring to lichdom? Is my fluff completely
I mean,
off
aspirational?
Here?
Maybe. Maybe. I mean, your pronunciation is, so I don't even know. I had so much plastic faith in him. Here we are.
I'm going to have to start playing P-Star right just there. So I can use this model.
But he is worth his own talking point, and I think I'm going to let Pat kick us off here, Pat.
Okay, so I know we mentioned this already, but I'll just recap his key abilities, the reasons you take him in the list. They're his magic abilities. So Death Ride gives friendly faction undead models in his command range +1 movement, and Mortal Fear gives living enemy models in his command range -2 to damage rolls. He also has Hellfire as a third option, which just was a really good ranged ability. Power 14 magic that also ignores tough and removes from play when it boxes a model. So he's got a really good selection of abilities. One of Scar's problems, like I mentioned, was the lack of threat range and +1 for what is effectively your whole army, except for Scar herself from Deathride, is really great. Mortal Fear is not especially good in this list because most Banes will die regardless in melee, but it has situational use, protecting cavalry and stalkers, and it's especially good protecting Wraith Engines because their stuff get to the point with base armor 18 and multiple boxes that it takes a good number of attacks to bring them down. And effective 1-2 damage really adds to that, especially when you factor in the rate of foil and there won't be that many attacks coming in on them. It's also worth mentioning, this ability is quite unusual in that it's -2 damage rolls, whereas a lot of similar abilities are -3. And it does work on ranged attacks. Now, you're not going to get many ranged attacks that are in his command range, but I found myself that it's very common when dealing with things like assaults or sprays. And, of course, that combined with the aura from the Wraith engine gives Banes a lot of survivability up close against the attacks.
Yeah, it also works against some goofy things like cavalry mount attacks and such, which is increasingly relevant in the world of Chosen. He's got a magical melee and battle wizard, so I've used him before to kill 2 gremlin swarms. Like if you're playing the way Pat does, where you have the sort of fort in front of a skin of bones or something like that, you can have him charge in, 3 dice to hit, kill a gremlin swarm with his rather impressive mat of 7, and then battle wizard a hellfire and hellfire the other one with again magic 7 to need a 6 to hit. And then kill it on, I mean, if it's under the death knell, you need a 5. If it's not, you need a less than that. And then, you know, from a 2-inch melee and 5 inches of the other one, he can repo 3 inches, which usually opens a really comfortable lane for whatever pieces you want to send in and kill the heavy that was being protected by those mummels.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning as well. He has pretty good synergy as a combat piece with Scar's abilities. He gets the extra dice on attack rolls, which means they work on impact attacks. If you target him as a feat target, he becomes 4 dice to hit on the charge with a power 18 attack. So you can surprise people with those abilities as well.
And he's a speed 8 model. So he goes for days. Again, has reach. 2-inch melee. I think he's... it's also worth pointing out he's a Dragoon, so one of the things people will do is they'll have a Mortal Fear bubble that's really causing them a lot of problems, and they'll want to kill Wraith Engines or something, and he'll be sort of, you know, in and amongst a bunch of troops sort of behind them, and they'll come up and they'll be like, well, he's a large base, so I can shoot him with all of these pieces, and I'll shoot him here, and I'll shoot him here, and eventually end up dismounting an ARM 17 model with, you know, a bunch of boxes is not trivial to shoot off the board, but eventually get him off the board. And then finally, having dismounted him, you'll be like, okay, well, now he's a small base, so you don't have line of sight to him or anything else, because he's behind.
No, I mean, he's definitely proven to be stickier than I anticipated when I've tried to remove him from the table. He requires a serious concentrated effort to kill, and like I said, really can be a very beneficial piece there. So for people playing against these lists, we kind of gone over playing around Daragoth Wraith. What are some other key points any faction needs to have in mind when playing into this list?
We've said it already, but you need magical attacks. And you need magical attacks in sufficient volume and power necessary to kill an armor 18 to 20. We'll call that an oscillating value because, again, Mortal Fear can affect it if you're not immune to Mortal Fear. Ranged attacks, you're dealing with armor 20. Like, the Wraith Engines are, you know, between 18 and 20. And a non-trivial defense value, they're def 12, so that can come up for them sometimes. And you need to be able to kill them on the right moment in the game. Like, either you have to kill them on the approach, which is very difficult because they're ultra fast, really, really far threatening pieces that are naturally resilient against guns. You need to kill them on the turn where their armor between 23 and 25, which is also very difficult. Or you need to be able to weather with whatever you have that can kill them, those 3 turns of the game, against often like 3 dice to hit, pow strength, 15 goes to 17, goes like just crazy high damage values, especially on the feat turn, for long enough that you can then kill them in the reprisal. So you need good ways to turn those pieces off. I think this list continues to be a compelling reason why trolls should, at least in one of the 2 lists in their pairing, have the Stone Scribe Elder rather than the Northkin Elder, because you really do need the ability to turn off incorporeal in these pieces. Even having said that, I think it's a matchup that they can sometimes really struggle with.
Yeah, it's worth re-emphasizing that the objective to get one magical attack alone is not enough, right? You can't, this is not a gremlin swarm. You can't just make an attack and kill it. So you need a way to consistently give high power models. Yeah, maybe. Like,
but I'd be boosting that damage roll.
Yeah, you can maybe do something with a conquest under Sorcerer 2's feet or something, but good luck.
Yeah.
So yeah, you need a way to give high-powered models consistent magic attacks. The other thing that I think is important into playing into Skaar in general is her key, the way she wants her game plan to work. She wants to be able to hit you with as many models as possible in a single turn. She wants to be able to hit your key models with models under her feet. And she would ideally like to be able to feat on the turn she charges so that your retaliation then is dealing with the armor half of her feat as well as the damage half that's just come in and wrecked your stuff. So this plan works really well if she can outthreat you. And when Skaar's army outthreats your army, it is often just a disaster. Like, those are the games that can seem really one-sided because you feel like there was nothing I could do. Her stats were too high, her models just charged me and killed everything they charged and I lost. But because she natively has no threat range buffs, she's only using Dara's plus one speed, and she has no ranged attacks to speak of, it is possible to make lists that out-threat her stuff. It's actually not that difficult, right? The highest base speed in her army is 7, I think. Maybe 8 on the cavalry.
8 on Dara, 7 on the cav. But I need to go to 8 with Dara, so...
Yeah. So... it's pretty, any army, any faction can make lists that outthreat that list. And once you can do that, you can stop her playing her dream game plan, right? And you force her to make some compromises and consider her strategy more. And that can give you an edge that you need to get into the game.
Yeah. And I think even if you don't necessarily outthreat her list, those games are obviously a lot more challenging. But layering is really important against her. And we talked a little bit earlier about the notion of defensively feeding. If you can rip a lot of pieces off the table in it for Skaar's list, then you're in a position where she will often have to get really, really far up the board, put a ton of pressure on pieces, and say, like, now I have to feed to prevent you from just killing pieces with guns. If you're in that situation, you're hugely advantaged, especially if the things that you bring to bear that do really threaten her and threaten the pieces in her army are also even medianly durable, because that puts her in a really good spot. We've talked previously in the High Reclaimer episode a little bit, and especially in the Kruger episode, about how sometimes these lists can be in real trouble if you just, put a lot of beef in front of them and just, put a lot of pressure on them by saying, kill as much as you can, I'll do work with what's left. That is not a strategy here. It will go very poorly.
Yeah, that's a disaster. This list can kill any number of things. Now, there is one exception to that, which I think is worth considering for some lists, which is, although every single attack this list makes is very high value, it doesn't actually make that many attacks. So you could put 6 heavies in front of this list and they'll all die. But mm-hmm. if you have, say, 2 units of high defense infantry, that can get you a lot further. And that can sometimes be a problem, especially if you're playing very spread out. They can't all necessarily get dark guidance. Or if you can push your defense so high with buffs that mat 6 plus 3d6 or mat 7 plus 3d6 isn't always hitting. And then you have other defensive tech like tough on top of that. You can get to the point where infantry skews can actually do quite well. And I found that to be the case with Crucible Guard, where defense 18 rocket men actually can just tank Bane Warriors all day long. But there aren't that many lists that can do that kind of thing.
You have to be a little bit careful mm-hmm. because Tartarus is event leader, so they can get up to mat 7. Bane Cav can get up to mat 8, and they can make like multiple impacts in tactical spots. So don't just do that and think it's going to be fine. Like, there's a lot of positioning game that has to be played in that particular strategy. Mm-hmm. But I do think defense 18... very well may be a tipping point. Just keep your officer very safe, because he's the linchpin to that particular strategy.
Yeah, so I think that's something that works. The other thing I'd say is this list is pretty good against range attacks because of the fact that almost everything has Prowl or Stealth, and then you have the Aura from the Wraith Engines as well. But it's not immune to range attacks by any means. And if you have decent power range attacks, especially sprays, then you can do a lot of damage and cause a lot of headaches for this list.
I think Sloane can be a good drop here, especially if you've got pieces like Arlen, Ion and Holt, ideally access to a magical objective. She's got a lot of damage. She's got the ability to see through stealth, which allows her to kill stalkers pretty effectively. Multipliers for accuracy. She's not afraid of prowl. She has to do, and this is going to sound like, you know, pedantry to every single Sloane player who's ever played a game, but she has to do a lot of work with her guns before they get into melee or shoot the game.
Shocking. Like, yeah.
Welcome to any matchup where you're playing all guns. But, you know, if you play a really conservative approach-oriented game where you've got tools to sort of buy yourself some space, I think she can, you know, really answer the things that Scarpa
Yeah, I agree.
Which is one of the reasons that I like her.
One of the things that I think this kind of list is also vulnerable to is it's a linear list that basically has a plan and is playing to maximize its own plan. With the exception of the Cephalux Overlords, it has very little tech or alternate options, and it's very vulnerable to control, especially control that is tech for it in mind. So, for example, it can't really deal with upkeeps that are on its units. Bane Riders are very vulnerable to knockdown. I wouldn't do that on the Warriors, as they have Rise. The Wraith Engines, being battle engines, are very vulnerable to things like Blind, Shadowbind. You have a lot of defensive abilities that can neuter big parts of the list. And because the list is low model count, if you can control a few of those models, it can go a huge way towards letting you kind of get the edge and just take control of the matchup.
Yeah, referencing our previous episodes, I think Kruger 2 can be quite favored here. List building a bit dependent, but he's got a lot of tools that allow him to screen effectively. The feat ends up being quite relevant. TK on models that want to charge and don't have any way to turn themselves around is really valuable. Regarding our High Reclaimer list, interestingly, that matchup oscillates very aggressively, dependent on whether or not you have access to magical weapons on the Judicators. If you have Ion and Holt, that matchup is fairly favorable. If you don't, Wraith Engines take over the game,
yep.
Which is kind of the point we're making with Wraith Engines. The right answer is not always to get the most damage out of them. Sometimes the right answer is to get the most game out of
them. That's interesting, right? Because if I'm running a double Judicator list and my opponent has this list and I don't have a way to give my Judicators magic weapons, which is probably the case if I'm running double, then as a Scar player, I can just run my two Wraith Engines as far forward as I want and threaten at any time to feat on them, and combined they can charge in and kill a Judicator, right? I could potentially, with Stalkers, get to a position where I can send a Stalker and a Wraith Engine on both and threaten to kill or cripple both of them. And that just seems disastrous.
Yeah, and I think you can play a really patient game with Scar there, because if you've got Judicators buying you real estate, Wraith Engines buying you real estate, the Judicators have a really hard time, like, literally getting around them. They can walk through them, and they can ignore... Like, they don't get to make free strikes against you, but they just physically take up so much table space that the things that already restrict placement of Judicators restrict them even more aggressively when they're also trying to negotiate their way around not being inside two huge bases.
Yeah, that seems good.
Yeah, and real quickly, before we move on there, I just had a question. So when we talked about the High Reclaimer Judicator in episode 2, we talked about how it was more about the Judicator and less about High Reclaimer. Is this also true for the Wraith Engine? Does that stand alone here, or is it really P-Scar polishes everything the Wraith Engine needs?
Wraith Engines are good. Dark Guidance is really good.
Yep. I think there was a point in the meta where when the Wraith Engine came out of CID and people hadn't adapted to it and everyone was terrified of them and a lot of lists couldn't handle them. But that was a while ago. That was maybe 18 months ago. And now people have adapted. I don't think the Wraith Engine is the terror it was. It's just a solid piece that is quite applicable in a lot of matchups, but not always great. And this whole list is really models that take advantage of Scar. And the Wraith Engine is there as an extra piece of synergy. But it's by no means necessary. You can play a lot of different themes and armies that all take advantage of Scar in different ways. You don't necessarily need this model.
You know, this feels like an oversight, but I'm not sure if we even mentioned extended control range on the Stalkers.
I actually want to talk about stalkers in detail because I love stalkers. I think they're great.
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about them now. What do you want to talk about with stalkers, Pat?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so what do I want to talk about stalkers? Like Tim said, extended control range on stalkers is amazing because of the feat and dark guidance, right? So Scar can be anywhere on the table almost, and those things will always get to mat 7 plus 3d6 to hit, power strength 17 blessed with two initials on her feat turn. They've got grievous wounds, so they can advance up, leap, and make four boosted attack roll power 17s onto a heavy target. Against a lot of targets, that'll kill them. Against a lot of others, that will cripple them with grievous wounds and make them unable to retaliate against a Def 15 Armor 18 Stalker. They're incredibly obnoxious to deal with. They're basically the perfect piece for Scar 1 because they play perfectly to her game plan, which is they're the highest melee threat range model available for her battle group. I'm waiting now for Tim to come up with some obscure exception, but I'm pretty sure the highest threat.
Theoretically a Kraken, which is also a reasonable piece, but yeah.
Kraken also plays perfectly into the plan.
The thing is, like, I say theoretically Kraken because I think it's a good piece, and obviously it can charge 8 and is a 4-inch melee, so like that's a good number. But Stalker's actually threat further than that, and more importantly, you can flank super, super deep with them and still have them be eligible feat targets, which is something that a lot of people just don't have an answer to. And to stay out of threat range of the Stalkers, like, is to cede the table.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. One of the things that's great about having four Stalkers is you can deploy them spread across the table and be in positions where two of them can gang up on an especially resilient heavy. So you can threaten to kill basically anything that comes in threat range. Because of advanced deployment plus the high threat, if you go first, you get in a position where the second player is in threat range as long as they move their models forwards, which they have to do. And they can really warp the game, where if you don't have a good answer to Stalkers, either in your list or in how you play or execute your first turn, you're basically just trapped, where you can't move your army forward without all of your key pieces, or, heaven forbid, your caster just getting wiped off the table on turn two. I just think they're awesome. Very hard to deal with at range, thanks to Def 15 and Stealth, and the ability with Pathfinder and Leap to just hide behind terrain and be very safe. And just perfect for Scar and her game plan.
They can usually be in rubble or cover. There's a lot of situations where, you know, people will come up and they'll offer like a very unproductive feat to Scar. They'll be like, here's a couple of pieces you can kill with your Stalkers, but only the Stalkers can get in. Haha, I've outsmarted you. And then you just sort of just back off your Stalkers a little bit. I'm like, all right, I'll wait till I've got a better one.
Yeah. It's worth mentioning that with four Stalkers, Scar can often fully fuel them because, of course, she gets the extra D6 focus from her sacrifice ability. You sometimes see variations of Scar lists that have some number of battle group models on Icos, the junior, because he has escort. So he gives whichever warjacks he has +2 movement. And you often see him either with a Kraken or with Stalkers for exactly the reasons we just mentioned. They're the highest base threat range, and he extends it even further. And 13 inch range Stalkers are hard to deal with, but 15 is even more of a nightmare. And they can still benefit from Scar's feat and Dark Guidance.
Sorry to interrupt, Pat. I just want to make very, very clear for folks, because I've seen this mistake made a lot. We talked about how Scar can make really good use of those Stalkers because she can fully fuel them. What you're saying specifically is that, you know, you roll your ritual sacrifice the previous turn for the next turn for Scar, or you roll it at some point during the turn. Either way, it doesn't make a difference. But you've got a number sitting on your Scarlock that you know is coming. Say that number is 4 or 5. Scar can't actually allocate that focus. She has to allocate from her personal reservoir of 6. But she will then still receive that focus when she activates, because she gets the focus on her activation, not in the maintenance or control phases. But she needs to have personally 4 focus to cast Dark Guidance anyway. So what you're basically saying is that she can allocate more or less her entire stack of 6 and still have the tools necessary to cast the Dark Guidance she wants, or possibly heal herself.
Yep.
Allocating 6 is still pretty good for somebody who's focused 6 and still needs to cast a 4-cost spell.
I mean, allocating 6 is exactly 3 Stalkers, right? Yeah. Which is pretty great.
I mean, the list has one redundant stalker, but that's okay. You don't usually get everything on everything.
I mean, honestly, you're playing in the sprinkler. If all four of your stalkers are in threat range where they want to have three focus allocated, you're probably, at that point, you've almost certainly run regardless. So
it's probably the situation where they put six heavies in range and we're like, I'm just going to tank it.
Yeah. One thing I want to mention, though, is it is easy to fall into the trap. And I've seen opponents do this where you get so excited by how ridiculous the stalkers are that you end up feeding too early. And even though stalkers with the feet are great, it's often not worth feeding on your second turn to get that alpha with the stalkers where it's not affecting anything else in your army offensively. And you need to consider if your opponent can reasonably threaten those models. And if they can't, then just hold back and wait for that time where you can at least send in some Wraith Agents and some cavalry to join them before using your feet.
Yeah, I talked about the sort of, you know, your opponent gives you an unproductive feat. One of the strategies in playing against Scar for sure is you're going to have to eat an alpha on something if you don't out-threaten her with everything. And even if you do, you probably will have to at some point in time. And just giving her a very bad alpha is, you know, the best way to blunt her offense, because the only damage multiplier available to Scar is the feat. So she does need to do an enormous amount of work on that turn. I mean, like, when I say only one, you know, she's backed up by a whole bunch of weapon masters. She's got dark shot all over the place. But as a caster, she doesn't have a damage multiplier outside of the plus five strength feat she has.
So that measly plus five.
Fine. Just basically you're fine. Yeah. But you can give them a very unproductive feat if you're like, kill two heavies. Oh no, what will I do now? And the rest of your list has sufficient power to punch back. That can put you in a really advantaged situation against the list.
Yes, it can be really nice. And yeah, the Stalkers in particular are the models in the army that start to fall the most flat after the feat turn, where with base power 12 and base armor 13, they tend, if they've gone in under feet and not killed their targets, they tend to flail around ineffectually and then die.
You can have your opponent commit to spending a bunch of resources to kill feated on Stalkers. That's very productive for you because their defense 15 is their main way to protect themselves. So then they're dealing with defense 15 and armor 18, which means sometimes they keep a couple of aspects. And even with a couple of aspects, Stalkers are still kind of scary, and they're not significantly more scary when they're fully functional than they are with a couple of relevant aspects at power strength 12 Grievous. Like, sometimes all they need to do is just tag a heavy who took a ton of damage on the previous turn. And they're like, well, one die to hit, dark guidance, that's two. Oh, looks like I hit you. You're Grievous again. Do no damage. That's fine. You still don't have a spirit.
So we've kind of talked about it a little bit. Pat mentioned possibly taking Iacos, but what are some variations we could expect to see with this list? I've seen versions that only run two stalkers with an inflictor, which is kind of maybe a safety net version. I've seen 24 Bane Warriors. Can we highlight a few of them and their pros and cons?
So, yeah, for sure. We mentioned the Kraken as a good option for the battle group. I think generally, in this theme force, you don't want to spend too many points on battlegroup models because the Banes are what are giving you the free points and are what are really benefiting from the theme force bonuses. So you tend to just need to choose between some number of Stalkers versus one or two Heavies and maybe a Kraken as your sole battlegroup model. And the Heavies tend to be more flexible but aren't abusing Scar's game plan quite as well. I think pretty much every Bane in the theme is great, and great with Scar. So depending on what exactly you're planning to fight against, you can definitely consider any number of Riders, Warriors, or Knights, and they all have different pros and cons.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, obviously, Cav getting the additional die on their impact attacks are fantastic. I've seen double Max Cav, I've seen double Min Cav. Both of those have relevant bonuses. There are people who play with or without the Overlords. I think we've already talked a bit, maybe ad nauseum, about how fantastic Overlords are, but that's certainly a variation that you see. One of the things that I saw the German players emphasizing is having an Arc Node in the battle group. It costs you usually a Stalker, but putting some kind of a budget piece in there. If you've got the points of flexibility, a Ripjaw is a really cool piece because it's got powerful attack and a critical effect. So it's actually like, it can do a ton of really relevant work on the feat turn. Critical armor piercing on a POW base 10, usually dark shroud for 12, sometimes 17 if it's like a target you can feed on. It can do it can be a work piece, but more importantly, it gives you access to like a late game Scar Hellfire is a key model or she uses excess, because again, Hellfire is an RFP spell. So normally she can't cast it because she's busy staying safe behind clouds and being really conservative in her play. But putting like one arc note into it, she's not a spell slinger, but it just gives you a little bit of a reach factor, especially in matchups where RFP can be a really relevant effect on like one or two key models throughout the course of a game. That's a variant that I think is compelling in its own way. The Inflictor, you already mentioned, but one of the things that I think is really good about that heavy, actually, for the record, don't really like that variant. But to give it its due, it's a crit poison model, so it's got really good synergy with Dark Guidance, where all of your melee attacks have a good chance of critting. It's a shield guard, so it can protect your Wraith Engines from things like a blind shot from Gorman. It also protects Scar from just sort of a rogue shot that might take her out. It gives her another layer of defense, especially if you're losing games on Scar dying. And it gives you the sort of anchor heavy piece that can go in and potentially take over a game if you're in a situation where something that's even moderately durable doesn't have anything that can tackle it anymore, because your feated on models earlier in the game took out all of the heavy hitting pieces. So I think it's an interesting variant. Obviously, we're talking about the list that's here because I think it's maybe one of the best versions of the list. But this list has the potential to shift around a little bit and evolve dependent on what it needs to address in the metagame.
Yeah, one other battlegroup model that I think is worth mentioning, because you sometimes see it, is the Desecrator, which is a heavy. The key points that it has going for it in this list, it has Accumulator Bane, so it gets focus points for activating within 3 inches of Bane models, which are going to be all over the table, so it's very focus efficient. And then it's got a range 12, power 14 AoE 4 gun that lays a 4-inch AoE corrosion field in play that undead models can go through, but others take a point of damage. So it gives you a bit of... it gives you more ability to deal with large amounts of infantry and control their movement, which is one of the things that the list can be a little bit weakened to with its low volume of attacks.
And it's got a crit effect too, so it's another synergy piece for Dark Guidance when you close in melee. Because Desecrators are Shred, I think, I want to say.
Yeah, they've got Crit Shred and Grievous Wounds. So yeah, they will tear it up in melee.
Yeah, and they're the Crab chassis. So if you're running like two of them as your battle group and you're ensuing stalkers, you can put them base to base with each other and have Scar hide behind them because they're steady. And she can use that as sort of line of sight blocking pieces to play a little bit further forward if she doesn't want to be behind the clouds. I mean, she probably wants to be behind the clouds, but that's a good place to be too. It's hard to put something in the Scar list and have it not end up being good. She's a quintessential polisher. She wants the things she brings to be melee, and she wants them to be fairly hard hitting so she can emphasize that element of her game. But otherwise, you know, she's just a good caster.
You heard it here first.
So we've gotten over kind of the key points of what Scar is trying to do. We've talked about key points on how to play against her. We've talked about herself and her solos. We've given some specific examples for playing into her. So right now, it is November of 2018. Is P-Scar worth specific tech if you're looking at traveling in the national level? And the reason I ask this is, obviously, the metas that Pat and Tim play in are different, right? Are clearly different. So do either of you consider P-Scar when making your list pair?
Yes.
I think you have to. She's somewhat evergreen, right? What she does is simple and powerful and effective, and it always plays well into some portion of the field. So you will often see her as a main list or an off list, depending on how the meta is shifting. But she's been a presence on competitive tables for years, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Like, if a new Crix player was asking me, like, I want to buy an army, and I want it to be a pretty competitive Steamroll army because I want to try that, but I also want it to be something that I can put a lot of effort into painting and probably play for like years to come. I think Scar's high on that list in Crix. I mean, lots of things fluctuate with metas, but she's proven to be in the spot Privateer Press wants her to be. And she's a shark. Like, she hasn't left and she hasn't evolved. She's the same predator she was in Mark 1? Like, you know, things have shifted a little bit, and occasionally she tweaks the points in the list a tiny bit, but you know, as long as, you know, you bear in mind some of the flex pieces we talked about and don't skew too aggressively in one direction, she should always be strong. If you're playing against Crix and you don't, if your Crix drop doesn't have a solid P-Scar matchup, it's not a Crix drop.
Yeah, I do think that's very true. She's almost like the level one of teching into Crix is whenever you're planning to deal with Crix, you need to have an answer to models that will just kill you in melee, can deal with any amount of armor, and to Wraith Engines. And those things can be seen in a lot of different Crix lists, but Scar just runs the most, almost the definitive version of that list.
Yeah, and there's a lot of situations where, like, if you're quite favored into Scar, you're comfortable into Lich 2. If you're quite strong into Scar, you're good into Gorshade 2. Like, you can incidentally address a lot of things that are present in Crix as sort of semi-evergreen or at least moderately popular lists by being good into Scar, who's the sort of defining element of the faction.
Yeah, and I think Tim brings up a great point. While we're talking about Steamroller pairs, what are some pairs that P-Scar players should consider when they're looking to go to an event?
So I think because of the nature of the list being simple and effective at what it does, it's really, you need to be thinking about what you're expecting to face that counters that list. We talked already about certain things that give it a hard time. You need to make sure, first and foremost, you're not building a list that is too similar and will fold to the same things. And what that means is you will often need a more tricky Crix list or a Crix list that approaches the game from a different angle. Almost certainly it will play in a different theme force. But you can't just be taking... It's not one of those situations where you can just be taking a different caster and that will solve all your problems. Because a lot of the list strength is on the back of Banes and Wraith Engines and how they work. And if your opponent can kill those models, almost no caster in the faction is going to save you.
Yeah, she's a force and she always will be. But you have to make sure that, you know, if you're expecting someone who's done a good job of teching for P-Scar, I don't want to emphasize this too much, but we've talked a little bit about the sort of sweeper pivot paradigm before. Scar is a sweeper. She's a really, really powerful, really, really linear list that you should expect to be aiming to drop in circumstances where your opponent doesn't have a clear and present answer to her. If she has a clear and present answer to her, you have to step back into a list that has flexibility, emphasizes trickiness, emphasizes tools that are strong, almost agnostic of the list that you're facing down against. The temptation is to play P-Scar with like Asphyxius Nine Slayers, and like that's not a bad pairing in terms of objective power level, but sometimes you'll see opponents who have like a good Nine Slayers answer and a good P-Scar answer, and now you're in a circumstance of list chicken. That's what inevitably happens to people who play kind of two sweepers that skew in different directions. And if you play two sweepers that skew in the same direction, like you play her with Gorshade 2 in Dark Host as well, you know, you know what list you're going to play into, and it answers you, and hopefully it doesn't answer you good enough, or you lose based on the merits of that list. I would emphasize playing her with something that has a lot of tools, flexibility, and options. I might want to play something that, you know, doesn't really care if you have a ton of magic weapons, doesn't really care if you have a ton of stealth outs. Maybe something that has a lot of presence, maybe something that brings some guns. I think interesting pairing options would include many variations of Ghost Fleet, which is still a list that's relevant in Crix. Slaughter Fleet, either with Scar 3, who's a very natural, balanced caster who can play in that dynamic really well. Slaughter Fleet with a Denegra 1, who's got a lot of powerful tools, and give her access to something like Shard Pirates that can do work in places where Scar doesn't really necessarily want to play. I would look to another theme and I would want to compliment. There'd be nothing wrong with playing something like Denegra 2 in Black Industries. She's a really, really flexible, really dynamic caster who's maybe just playing such a different game that it creates complicating problems. Those are some of the lists that I would consider looking at. Crix is pretty deep. The roster is pretty available to you, but in concept, your second list should emphasize flexibility and should probably not try to be about objective power level.
Awesome. No, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, and hopefully the aspiring Crix players out there can glean something from that. So if P-Scar sounds interesting to people, but maybe you don't like playing undead things, maybe Crix just isn't appealing, what are some other things people should look at if P-Scar sounds interesting?
I really like Coedcetixis. It's not especially innovative. It may not even necessarily be better than the list we've just talked about. But Cetixis are another unit in Crix that natively have a very high threat range and are resistant to ranged attacks. So it's quite easy for Scar to deliver them, and then you feat and you dark guidance and they smash everything. So you can, and I know a lot of people are fans of the aesthetic. It's especially cool, obviously, because Scar is herself a Cetixis. So you can make a very cool army in that space and have it still be very effective.
And there's some synergies there that are pretty cool. For one thing, most Cetixis have crit knockdown and Scar's dark guidance. So obviously that fits very nicely with her toolkit. Most Cetixis have feedback. She has backlash. So that's double dipping on that mechanic to really threaten some kind of cool assassinations. I think Scourge is a really cool list. And if you're really excited about that kind of thing, I think it presents Scar in a different sort of dimension. There'd be nothing wrong with playing, like, say, a Stalker heavy battle group and then a Cetixis-themed army. You're going to get more native accuracy and a bit of a light defense skew in terms of the pieces that you're presenting, plus similar terrain-agnostic stuff and, like, theme benefits that give you different things. Your trade-off is you've got less objective damage, you have less of an incorporeal skew, but you've got things like ambush, and you've got access to some cool counter assassination tech, like the Cetixis Raider Captain, who has what's the rule? No sleeping on the job. No sleeping on the job. Mm-hmm. Cetixis, which applies to Scar as well. So
yes,
like that makes her better into like Krios one, for example. And you know, she doesn't get a jack thrown at her and just get knocked down. Her defense value continues to stay relevant for most of the game if you've got one of those solos to kind of babysit and predict your caster a little bit. Plus, you can play Severa and Axiara, both of whom are just, like, nuts good.
Yeah, they're crazy powerful. And you have even some range attacks now with the Gunslingers to give you a few more options. One of the things I love about that list is the First World Crix problem of, I want to assassinate you with backlash and feedback, but if I feat, I'm going to kill your jack too quickly. And when you're in that kind of situation, you know the list is good.
Yeah, like... Oops. I mean, sometimes you just backlash a jack that you know you're going to kill before you kill them because you're like, well, maybe you take 9 points of damage and that's fine. Or 10 points of damage. So.
Yeah, keep you honest next turn.
Yeah, now that you've taken 10 points of damage or maybe had to reduce some stuff with focus, maybe I'll just kill you later. Like, do you ever have a point in time against the Scarlist where you feel comfortable just spending back not to be doing work but just to heal your caster? Because the answer won't surprise you.
So those are some great ideas, and definitely Crix players can check it out. Do we have anything for non-Crix players that a list that would play or feel similar to a Peacegar Dark Roast?
So I think Peacegar is almost the definition in War Machine and Hordes of just like infantry Rapper Master spam. That's the way she was played through a lot of Mark II, and it's a way a lot of her lists can often feel like playing now. And I think that archetype is often really powerful because it's a skew list that will often... be a useful answer in a meta if the meta has too much armor. Most factions can play some variation of infantry that hit pretty hard and have some good defensive abilities. So examples are Legion of Steel. In Kador can feel a bit like playing Dark Host. Another example might be something like Kallus One, who is also a Dark Guidance caster, running Rapid Master Infantry and using his feet to essentially recur them. But most factions can play something like that.
Yeah, I think if you're talking about like the combination of hit fixing and damage, you know, Animag is there. Kallus is already mentioned. You've got both Arusks who play some mention of that. Arusk 1 is probably the most like Scar in terms of the way his kind of personal kit unfolds on the table, but I mean, no one's going to quite be like two Wraith engines and a whole bunch of things that just hit enormously hard. Like Crix is the core identity of Crix that has now sort of evolved beyond it, but the way this list is very old Crix, which is we've got some good delivery mechanisms and we've got terrible access to guns and threat ranges, but man, do we hit hard when we get there and we're going to give you some problems. And this is that list at a pinnacle. So kind of everyone can do it, but also kind of no one does it quite like Scar.
All right, guys. Well, hopefully that gives you some information to get started playing Piskar, maybe take your play to the next level, and hopefully you won't be as afraid of her next time you see her across the table. Be sure to follow us on Facebook at Battle Tips to stay up to date with all of our future Tactical Tips episode. We're planning on releasing 2 episodes a month, and we would love any feedback on lists you'd like us to review. I'd like to thank both of our hosts for coming on today. Tim, do you have anything fun in the works people should know about?
Pretty quickly here, I'm going to War Machine Weekend, which I'm real excited about. It's a great event and has always been a lot of fun. I think when this episode releases, I may have already gone to War Machine Weekend. I don't know. If this is a time traveling conversation, then thank you to everyone at War Machine Weekend. If it's not, then I look forward to seeing you all at War Machine Weekend.
And Pat, what about you? Anything exciting on the horizon?
I'm off to ClogCon, not this weekend, but next. So really looking forward to that. At the moment, I'm torn between whether or not this is my last hurrah with Grimkin, or my first foray into a convention with Crucible Guard. The challenge with Crucible Guard, of course, is a lot of their best models aren't quite released, and some of them release on that weekend. So that could be tough, but we'll see which way I fall.
Well, I'm excited to catch up with you, Pat, afterwards and see what's going on. Tim mentioned War Machine Weekend, and Carl announced he is going to be stepping down from head organizer, I believe is the correct term. And I just wanted to thank Carl for all the years of service and all the work and time he's put into that convention. I've enjoyed it when I've gone there as a casual, and I am excited to go there this year with a more invitational focused view. So thank you very much, Carl. Best of luck in future endeavors, and I wish you good health.
Yeah, I'll echo what Sung just said. Huge thank you to Carl. I've been to War Machine Weekend many times, both as a judge and as sort of a volunteer assistant, and also as a player in the Invitational. And Carl is, I think it's probably fair to say, maybe the best convention organizer in the community. Certainly someone who puts on a really amazing show, something that both Matt and myself, when building the Sioux, really modeled what we built after the success he's had. And someone who's always had just infinite patience with the just huge amounts of problems that can come up there, and has always had a smile on his face and an enormous amount of enthusiasm, and having enough background perspective to know that the experience of running a convention is just everything always being on fire. I have nothing but admiration for the man and the many, many years of attention he's put into it. Huge thank you to him. You've been a big part of my story in this game and my success and everything that I love and find enthusiastic about it. So I can't thank you enough. There literally aren't the words.
All right. Well, for Pat and Tim, this is Sung Soo wishing you all good health and good gaming. Till next time. Cheers.
I think people like the element of humanity that happens when we make mistakes or sound like idiots.
Okay.
It helps with Pat's cover, and it humanizes me.
Okay.